No Direction and Paizo team up to bring you the Gen Con 2018 seminar coverage. No Direction would like to thank our advertising sponsor, the Roll for Combat Starfinder Actual Play Podcast. Listen at rollforcombat.com.
All right, welcome everybody to Setting and Scene. This is our GM-facing panel. For us here to give our best tips and tricks for creating compelling game worlds for your players, as well as creating some memorable scenes for your players to experience at the table. If you want to hear outlandish stories about the things that we do in our games and how we help bring them to life, this is the panel for you. I'm going to go ahead and start out with some introductions of our panelists. I am Amanda Hammond-Kuntz. I am the managing developer for Starfinder at Paizo.
I'm Eleanor Farron. I am a developer on the player companion and campaign setting lines.
And I'm Jason Tondro. I'm one of the editors at Paizo. So we work on everything.
Yeah, Jason's one of the all-seeing eye overlords, hovering above all the words that we publish and pointing out the typos before we go to print.
Build more overlords.
So before we get into some questions for the panelists and then get into some questions from you guys, I want to ask just a question of everybody who's here. Who's here to hear specific advice for Starfinder games? No. Okay, so many people. Nobody for those watching at home. Who's here for specific advice for Pathfinder games? Okay, so the rest of you are here just for general advice
on anything?
For GM?
Great,
excellent. I can work with that. We're going to talk a little bit about both of the major topics of this panel, which is, of course, settings, so campaign settings in the worlds in which your games are set, and scenes, specific scenes of the tables, cinematic combats, ways that GMs are describing what's happening, and that sort of thing. So for the first question, I'm going to throw it down to Jason. What is one of your favorite pieces of Paizo setting lore that you've used, developed, written, or experienced in any way,
right,
and why?
So about last month, I turned in the manuscript for Starfinder Adventure Path 18. Now, I can't say the title because that would be a spoiler. But we do know that it's called the campaign adventure path is called Dawn of Flame.
Yes.
So it's set on the sun. So the player characters are adventuring on the sun. That's the first thing. And I'm writing the last adventure in that series. So my adventure is set in the sun, in the sun's core. So we're talking about... So I did some research. Right, I did some research, and I found out that in the sun's core, it's mostly hydrogen, 70% hydrogen, it's 30% nitrogen, at the edge of the core. This is all inside the sun. Well, at that pressure, at the intense pressure, that deep inside the sun, that hydrogen, nitrogen, is actually solid. It has a density higher than styrofoam, a little bit less than cork, which means that you can walk on it. If you can live in the sun, right? Now, this is Starfinder, where, like, you can live in the sun. Like, you got to give the players a suit of armor or a magic armor upgrade or something that gives them the solar adaptation trait. But if you can do that, how many times do your players get a chance to walk on the sun, right? They're going to tell that story for years. Like, oh, and then we had to sneak into the base by walking across the sun, right? So my point with this was a little bit of research gave me this really cool idea that created an opportunity that the players would never otherwise be able to do. And research is so much easier now because of our online world, you know? Like, we can do all that. I mean, this took me 30 minutes, right, a Wikipedia and a little bit more research. So research helped me get to that and helped me create this really unusual environment that was kind of a once-in-a-campaign moment that the players would... Not, then all I had to do was think up a reason for them to actually do walk on the sun, right? I had to come up with a reason for them to get out of their ships and have to walk some distance, right? Maybe it's infiltrate the base or rescue somebody or salvage something.
Or they need a really good campfire.
But so all I had to do was think up a reason. But once I could do that, the research kind of gave me the inspiration for the idea.
So what creatures live on the sun, Jason?
Well, if I told you, I'd have to kill you.
Oh,
but,
no.
but the cover of Dawn of Flame uses Ifrit. So look at all of your fire elemental, right? Azers and Ifrit and Ifrits and anything that was native to the elemental plane of fire, Starfinder can just give solar adaptation and let them, right? So that was a lot of fun to do.
Very cool. Eleanor, what about you? What's one of your favorite pieces?
So I've always been fond of the psychopomps, namely because, well, really all the outsiders, Because they're supposed to be avatars of these implacable forces, the pure goodness or pure evil, or in the case of psychopomps, the inevitability of death. But they all have personalities, they're all flawed, they can screw up and fail. And so you've got sort of this weird contradiction where you have these personifications, but they're actually people, which means that their personalities can sort of jam up what should have been a relatively easy task. Like in our world, you know, death, you just die. But you know, in Pathfinder, you can play chess with death if you feel like it. And in a particular adventure that we were running, there was this elf that was trying to do a deathbed conversion because she'd done a lot of nasty things in a war. And someone was trying to assassinate her, so they hired the PCs to stop that. And they were looking through her enemies, which she had plenty of, were trying to see, you know, maybe devils or demons are trying to kill her before she can deathbed convert and her soul wouldn't go to what they believed they had earned her soul. And if she converted, then it would just go to her deity's domain instead. But what they actually found was that it was a bunch of psychopomps who didn't want to redo the paperwork that they'd already started on her soul. And so they had to negotiate with a bunch of really bored paper clerks and paper pushers. And to get there, they had to go through all of the paperwork and paper pushing in Death's domain and try and bribe these supposedly implacable forces of death to just leave this elf alone so they could just get their job done. And that's the sort of what I liked about it, is that you can have these human elements screw up what should have been just a normal natural process, and that means you can interact with them in interesting ways as opposed to just, you know, sitting back and letting it happen.
That is the most gothic description of a bureaucrat I think I've ever heard, and I kind of love it. So speaking of gothy things, one of my favorite pieces of recent setting lore that we've published is this campaign study book, Nadal, Land of Shadows. This is down in the booth, and I was a lead developer on this, and I'm just super proud of the way that it turned out. We got Leanne Marcel, the Pathfinder Tales author of all of the stories set in Nadal, to write most of this book. We also got Liz Liddell, who is one of our editors on staff, to write a lot of this book, and Ron Lundin and Mark Moreland, who are also just awesome staff members that we have. And this book is the first glimpse that you really have seen of Nadal, the nation that is under the shackles of Zan-Kuthan, the evil, shadowy god who's all about torture and pain and torment and suffering. And his clergy is in charge of this entire nation. And the book really goes into depth not only about what the locations are like in the nation, but really what daily life is like under an evil regime like this. And, you know, the way that the populace, especially in the rural areas, try to placate the clerics from the larger cities and try to pay lip service to this, to basically survive while still trying to undermine a lot of just the terrible evil things that happen in here. And you can literally, in the large gazetteer chapter, just open the book and look for any kind of inspiration. One of the interesting things about Nadal is that it's also one of the culturally oldest nations on Galarian. The whole reason that the populace is under the shackles of Zan-Kuthan is because that they prayed and asked for fealty, for redemption, basically, from Earthfall, this terrible catastrophe that happened in Galarian. And he said, "I'll protect you, but you have to swear your loyalty to me forevermore." And so they survived, but what they became was something probably a lot worse than actual death. So there are all of these locations that are like the Library Without Light, which is the oldest library in the Inner Sea that has relics and information and documents that date way, way back before any other civilization really existed, because it was all destroyed by Earthfall. So this book is just super rich with all kinds of setting stuff. I really want to run a campaign or a game in here, and in fact kind of have my eyes set on a playtest rules version of something, maybe at PaizoCon or at another convention later in the year. So that's one of my favorite recent ones. So in addition to campaign settings and having a rich world for your players to play in. Scenes are also very important to keep them engaged at the table and to keep them, you know, wanting to do cool stuff, cinematic things that are stories that you then tell, right, for months or years on end. I think all of you have probably experienced something that you tell people about some of your best gaming moments, and that's really what we're talking about here. So I wanted to throw it to our panelists to talk about some of their favorite scenes. Jason.
So I run a couple of games right now every week or every month, depending on how often we can get together, because it's the 21st century and we all have lives, right? But one of the games that I run is a science fantasy campaign. I use the Starfinder rule system, but I have a homebrew setting, the Empire Arcane, which is kind of a little bit more Dune-ish, a little bit more inspired by that kind of the universe run by great houses, and everything is just really, really old, and you know, not everyone knows how everything works anymore, and we're just kind of chugging along as the Empire kind of collapses in on itself from entropy. Well, anyway, so I had a new group, and I wanted to. They had to kind of learn the game system and learn the rules. So I wanted to give them a relatively confined environment that they could explore but not go too far afield on, right? So they didn't. Sometimes too many choices for a group can be as big of a problem as no choice at all. So I gave them a mission to steer a comet. This is a comet that's being used for terraforming. So the comet's it's a big giant ball of ice. So you aim it at a planet like Mars, and you crash it into the planet on purpose to alter the atmosphere and bring a bunch of water to the planet. So how do we do that? We build giant engines. So the player's task was to take these engines that had already been built and to basically clamp them onto the comet and activate the nuclear reactor inside it to power the thrusters and then ride the comet in. But then the comet got sabotaged, so the players ended up stuck on a radioactive, out-of-control comet.
Seems fine. This is fine. Everything is fine.
Everything's fine. Well, anyway, so what that allowed me to do is I got to give them a time limit. Like, okay, you have 2 hours before the radiation from the reactor is so overwhelming that your suits will start to fail you, right? And I had a limited size playing field. Like, the comet's about 350 yards in diameter. You know, a good-sized comet, but not so big. They don't have their ship. The ship got blown up by saboteurs. So they have their suits, they have some gear, they have some equipment, and then it's sort of problem solving, right? And it allowed me to sort of push this along with my theme of the adventuring on the sun. I was trying to go for an extreme environment, right? Like, give them an extreme environment with a time limit, and then let them be cool, right? Like, give them a situation in which the only way to get off this planet, this runaway radioactive comet, is to be amazing, and then let them do that, right? So try to create the pressure cooker, and that's what I used for that. So that's my story about scene.
That's pretty cool. So like DC 10 probably to steer the.
Oh yeah, yeah. No. Well, I mean, never tell the players that you're adjusting the DCs by what they can actually roll, right? Like, never tell them that.
You just barely got it.
I'm a big fan of if they miss the roll, give them another chance, but it's harder.
Yeah.
And eventually, you know, they'll make it. Plus, they had some wiggle room. Like, okay, it like in a lot of science fiction games, like we know this from Star Trek, a little techno babble can go a long way, right? So, I didn't even try to figure out how to solve the comet problem because I knew that they would come up with a bunch of ideas, right? So I said, okay, here's the problem. I know the basic parameters. I know the problem. I know how it got to be this way. But then let the players come up with ways to fix it, and then just follow their lead. Does that make sense? And if they fail the roll, they're like, well, shit, we failed the roll. What do we do now? They'll think of what to do next, right? You just got to throw obstacles in their way.
Yeah. Give them just little hints of breadcrumbs of things that might possibly work.
If they get really frustrated, they're like, well, we don't know what to do. We have no actions. We're just going to lie here and get radiated to death. But
this is fine. Again,
don't let that happen. That won't happen. They'll be creative. Listen to your players. Yeah.
Eleanor, what's a cool scene from one of your games?
This is actually the same group as from the first story, and actually sort of a direct consequence of it, because they did such a good job, like, shooing away these clerks away from so that this old elven woman could get redeemed. They got hired to help with a different redemption case. He was just, like, this horrible, awful person, but had turned a new leaf, and a couple of good-aligned churches were sponsoring this guy. But there's always the stick-in-the-mud people who kind of want accountability for all those people he murdered. So At one point, one of the players got into an argument with one of the paladins who wanted to bring this person to justice. And it was just, you know, tooling along with your standard moral arguments. And at some point, the player got fed up and said, well, you know, basically it boiled down to, well, you know, sometimes life isn't fair and you don't get justice. What are you going to do about it? And this character did not have very much in the way of sense motive. And so when the paladin just decided to go away after that, she had decided that she'd gotten her point across, and maybe not that she had egged that paladin on to do something inadvisable. So we were already intending for there to be trouble between this person and these agents of the church, but now that the player had said that, we were just like, oh yeah. So at a certain point, she got separated from the rest of the group, and she was wandering around, and she stumbled upon that same paladin who had gotten into a fight with the person that they were trying to redeem and protect. They're like both mortally wounded almost, and one of the friends of this soon-to-be-redeemed person was trying to murder the paladin, and just like, we just dropped that on her. It's like, so, what are you guys gonna do? And
so you have a murder friend.
this is probably your fault. What are you gonna do about it? This character was sort of specced out to murder everything in a single round, so we sort of expected her to do that, but just, you know, more non-lethally. Instead, she decides to run in and try and talk everybody down. And again, this character didn't have a sense motive score. She couldn't convince anyone of anything unless she was lying to them. Mm. But we decided, you know, okay, roleplay talking them down. And the other players, even the other players didn't give any advice, because they were just sitting around going, well, we don't know how you're going to get out of this one, so we're just going to sit back and watch. But she did eventually, after a whole lot of stress, and the player later said that she had gone to her bookshelf and gotten out, you know, Communication for Dummies or whatever, and started reading through it while trying to come up with her arguments. But eventually she managed to... She figured out that, you know, maybe talking about forgiveness to the person that had been stabbed wasn't the best idea, and managed to talk down this friend by convincing her to just gaslight all of the lawful good people instead. But you know, it worked. They figured, hey, good enough. Nobody got murdered. So, but it was a pretty tense scene, especially because the player felt responsible for what happened. And I guess that's sort of no matter what you have planned, just keep an eye out for a way to hook your players into it because they said something dumb or because they are really invested in a certain person or just whatever they might have done. Have that show up later. It gets them more... And the best of ways, it gets them more invested. In the worst of ways, they feel like it's their fault and they need to fix it. But it makes for a pretty compelling scene.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm going to say that con games are a really good place to build a lot of really memorable, wild, outlandish scenes, right? Because you have a group of people who maybe they've come together to play because they're friends, but most likely they're probably coming and not necessarily knowing each other and coming together for the purpose of playing this game. So you as the GM really have this unique opportunity to just kind of like go with exactly what they want to do and let their characters kind of mesh together and have this really unique thing kind of build out, and scenes are a really big part of that. A couple of years ago at PaizoCon, I'm running Gallows of Madness, which is a module that also came out a couple of years ago. It's set in Sarengalo and Isgur, sort of this small town about the size of Sandpoint. And I'm running the first adventure in that three-part series called A Foul Breed. And that adventure, for those of you who are not familiar with it, is very roleplay heavy, and you're searching for information about these missing apprentices. And there's a long section about the town to tell you like what is there, but also who are the people whose apprentices are missing and might have information about what has happened to them. And so the PCs are set upon the mission of talking to each of these people who were the masters of these apprentices and figuring out what they were last doing and what maybe they think happened and all of that. And so there's a lot of role play opportunity. And one of the places that you go is the tavern in town. And it's run by this very surly tavern keeper who doesn't like outsiders, who's very suspicious of this mission. And as the PCs, you're trying to be discreet because you're trying to not incite panic in this town. And so really the mission before the PCs at this point was to get this tavern keeper to talk to them and to treat them as trusted advisors, so to speak, and give them information about what her apprentice was doing before they basically disappeared. And so there's many different ways that you can do that, but as the tavern keeper was talking about how she's had trouble keeping people coming in, and the foot traffic isn't what it used to be, and there are, you know, there's more competition than there used to be, one of the PCs gets this bright idea to drum up business. And what better way to drum up business than to have a loud public drinking competition in which you grab people from the docks on the river, sailors and people who clearly can hold their own, and have a competitive drinking competition type of thing. So I'm like, all right, that's a pretty cool idea. That's not something I would necessarily expect. This character is this 6 foot tall human barbarian, huge guy. He's got a con of 18 or 19. And, you know, this is before the drinking rules in Intercity Taverns comes out. So I'm like, all right, I'm just going to figure it out. And I'm having them do all of these checks, and they're gathering people, and the drinking starts, and all the PCs are involved, and they're downing drinks. I'm having them rolling con checks. I'm having them roll reflex save and dex checks, depending on the different things that they're trying to do while they're doing this competition. They're all trying to balance on the table, and they're trying to balance things like on their shoulders, and a halfling like jumps up on the human barbarian, and they're trying to stay still. And like all of a sudden, the different people involved start falling down. They start failing their checks. The other PCs go down pretty quickly. And, you know, it comes down to the human barbarian and this really big sailor guy, and they're matching each other drink for drink for drink, and I'm rolling, and he's rolling, and the entire table is just chanting for this guy to win, and the PC wins at the time. And so that was just a really fun scene. We had a couple people kind of poke their heads in and start to watch from the outside because of how loud the table was getting with the cheering. And I know that was a story that that this guy ended up telling, you know, for a long time. And so it required a lot of improvisation. It required a lot of just going with what the PCs wanted to do. And it required a lot of just sort of building the energy and, you know, the timing of the way the roles were happening and setting the DCs sort of on the fly. But just really going with that pace, I think, is what made that scene really memorable and something that people will still talk about from time to time. Right. Let's see. Jason, how would you like to give some tips for some folks for building rich campaigns?
Okay, so if my first lesson was, for me, was lots of research. And the second was this idea of sort of the extreme environment, like the, you know, sort of make everything as difficult as possible and then just let the players be awesome. How many of you have bookshelves of old game books at home? Yeah, or virtual bookshelves. This is for all of you. You will appreciate this story. So I also run a lot of urban fantasy. I wrote like a fate setting called Arthur Lives, which is about Arthurian reincarnations in the present. And the players, I needed to come up with a 1 hour, like a really short kind of introduction scenario because I was going to live stream it. And you know, you don't want it to be too long. It needs to be pretty self-contained. And so I went back to my old game shelf of old books. And you may remember D20 Modern? Remember D20 Modern? They came out with a great sort of, I don't want to call it a monster manual, but it was a collection of like bad guy organizations, right? With a bunch of stats in it for like terrorist groups and, you know, criminals and syndicates, stuff like that. And I dug out this map of a rich man's private yacht, which for a modern day setting is a perfect little dungeon, right? Like it's got lots of rooms, it's got multiple levels, I can put threats in it, but you can't, unless you can swim 100 miles, you're not leaving the boat, right? It's kind of that self-contained thing. And so I could put some cool adversaries in it and put a little a twist and a couple of unexpected things in some of the rooms, you know, and I could lure the players there and have some role play with the adversary for a while, and then the player characters start off the game separated and they kind of break free from their individual problems and then rejoin and have a confrontation with the big bad guy on the bridge of the ship or whatever. But the moral of that story to me was is don't hesitate to cannibalize all of those old games that you think you are never going to play again. Like all those old maps and all those old adversaries. The game system itself, you may not be running anymore, but you can convert all that stuff over probably on the fly. Like you don't even have to think about it that hard. And the graphic design that's gone into a lot of these books is still extraordinarily usable to all of us. Right? So whatever you're doing, like don't hesitate to go back and pull out all those old games. And chances are no one's going to recognize it anyway, but even if they do, like they're not going to remember it. It's not they're not going to be able to know the floor plan of the Pearl of Zandort, which was the boat I had to make, you know. So anyway, I really recommend going back and allowing yourself to enjoy all those old games again and use those physical props to help create the situation you need to make, especially when these days we don't all have a lot of time. Like GMs don't all have a lot of time to make adventures, you know. We have lives and jobs and families at home, and we have a lot of commitments. And so being able to pull like this map and this bad guy and this plot hook and then kind of bring them all together and then customize it for your particular group, because of course you'll do that, right? You'll want to customize it for your team. But once you do that, having all the ingredients there to do it makes it so much easier.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. What about you, Eleanor? What sort of tips do you have?
I'd second a lot of research, especially real-world events or historical events, because historical accuracy is really like the ultimate cheat code for having a unique idea in your campaign. Because there's a lot of things that you look up and you say, that can't actually be real. If I put this in my game, somebody would tell me it's completely blowing their sense of immersion. Yeah, but it actually happened.
Yeah.
If you go back, you know that like public hangings used to be family entertainment. Yep. You know, let's bring the kids out and watch somebody get themselves hanged, or the morgue. They used to open up the morgue to viewing for, you know, a nice Sunday afternoon for entertainment. Or, you know, if you go further back in history, there's tales of, like, a sports riot that ended up killing 20,000 people at the end of it because it got politics got involved and it got really complicated. And these sorts of things, it's just like these unbelievable like plots that actually worked that people got away with are you can mine these for all sorts of events and plots and villains, and your players will probably never see the twist coming because again they're so unbelievable despite the fact that they actually happened. So just looking at all sorts of insane events from history can be a real big source of inspiration.
Yeah, I think that's really true. And the key word there being inspiration, that you don't ever need to feel shackled to telling the story exactly the way it happened, if it's a historical event, or even if you're running a module, unless it's organized play, and you're just running in a home game or a con game or what have you, feel free to change things that you just would rather do a different way, or if you have an idea that you think is cooler, feel free to do that as well. Same thing with campaign settings. Yep. If you would rather have the evil king overthrown instead of something else that happens in the module in the background, that's totally a viable thing. You know, keeping notes is important if you're running like an adventure path or something, so that if there's ramifications down the line, you can make proper changes. But never feeling shackled to the way things are published as written, especially for, you know, for home games, can be a really great source of information. It can be very freeing for you as a GM to realize that you can literally do whatever you want. The players have no idea what's in the module. And some of the greatest stories that I like hear from folks at cons or read on the boards are things that GMs have added or embellished upon that are just like, wow, that's such a great idea. So just never feel hesitant to do that in your own games. So as far as scenes, which we talked a little bit about earlier, you guys want to talk a little bit about your tips for creating cool, memorable scenes that result in stories?
Oh gosh, I thought we just did that. I thought I was prepped for three things.
That's okay.
I'm going to pass.
Okay. What about you? You got some scene setting tips?
Top of my head.
Can we open up to Q&A?
Sure, yeah, let's do that. Who has questions for us? Anybody out there? We're just going to keep telling stories if you don't have questions. All right, right there.
I started building adventures mainly around scenes. So if there's a cool setting, I'm just going to love this. This is really going to stick in your mind on that, how you string it together, any thoughts about designing not adventures but scenes?
Yeah.
Okay. So the question is, what are our thoughts about stringing scenes together into a cohesive whole? Is that correct? Okay. What you got?
Well, this can be a real challenge because often I think, depending on what game you're running, and I don't know what system you're using.
This was
Cthulhu. The Call of Cthulhu was your system? Okay. Some games that are intentionally narrative in their design point out that one of the jobs of the GM is to start and end a scene. That is, the GM decides, okay, we're going to call that scene right there and then skip on to the next. When a GM doesn't do that, the scene kind of starts to peter out, you know, and it just kind of trails on and becomes a, well, what do you do next kind of thing. And we're trained that way, and Call of Cthulhu is a pretty old school game, you know, so we're used to saying, okay, well, as the keeper, the GM of Call of Cthulhu, you say, well, what do you want to do next? But what I would encourage you to do is think about a hard start and a hard end to that scene. So that you can kind of put it inside of, when the dramatic tension begins to run out of it, stop it. Don't let it keep petering. I know that we want to give the players more time to do what they're doing, but especially maybe talking about them with it. Like, I'm gonna try and start and stop scenes at particular moments and think cinematically, think like a television show, right? When have we milked as much as we can out of this moment? Cut, and then say, okay, now, what do you guys want to do next? And then go to that scene. And if you can, start with that scene already happening. There's a great old conversation about writing scripts, writing movie scripts. And Lou Hunter, who wrote Screenwriting 435, is a textbook for screenwriting. He used to ask a guy, how do you make such great movies? And the answer was, well, I just leave out all the boring parts. Right? But when you think about it, like, if, you know, you don't have to draw the guy driving across town. You don't have to draw him walking, write that scene where he walks up to the front door and knocks. You don't have to wait there for a minute and a half while he waits for the door to answer. The scene starts when the door opens, right? So look for those door opening moments and then door closing moments and try and string those together and skip the boring parts. But easier said than done, I know.
How about you, Eleanor? Do you have some advice?
Well, it's always tricky to go by a scene-by-scene basis for a game because I think every GM in this room knows that no plot survives contact with mm-hmm. any PCs.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it can still work out. I think what is best to do is to, whenever you have a scene, you need more than one way to end it depending on what happens. So you want to always have a good scene in mind for whatever the players do, whatever the consequences that come out of their actions. And that may involve having scenes that you set up and never wind
That's
up
right.
using.
Sure.
So it might just be, well, if they do this, then they go to that scene, but if they don't, they go to this scene and that or whatever. I think the important thing is just to make sure that you have something, you have a firm enough grip on what is causing these scenes.
Mm-hmm.
What is basically driving what is happening in all of this so that no matter what happens, you can move on to something that's still very scenic and atmospheric, but can be can have some wiggle room depending on what happens. And because of that wiggle room, you still have a satisfying narrative no matter what the players manage to do. And they manage some pretty interesting things sometimes.
Things that surprise me.
But they'll still get you to a really satisfying conclusion.
Yeah, so I'm a really big fan of preparing in advance of a specific session rather than trying to plan out an entire arc or even a campaign, especially if it's entirely homebrew.
Yeah.
So I'll sit down before the session mm-hmm. starts and, you know, unless it's the first session, I'll go back through my notes of what the players decided, and I take note of every little thing they do, every little decision that they do, choices that they make that seem very innocuous or not important to the plot. I always note because it's very fun to kind of pull from that and have those things be revisited later on. But during that prep session, in addition to, you know, like stat blocks and your additional normal prep that you would do, I will often do what it sounds like you're talking about, which is sort of map out what sort of scenes that they might encounter, and sort of think of it as like a line graph, maybe, of how impactful I think those scenes might be, how important they are to the plot, what hooks and what clues I'm going to be dropping along the way, and try to, in some ways, kind of anticipate what the major things I expect them to do are, and branch off from there for possible options. And of course, they're going to do stuff that I'm not going to be able to anticipate, and at that point, you just sort of throw the notes away and just kind of go on the fly. Which is its own thing, right? But being able to have an idea of those high points on the graph of what they may or may not be able to do, and sort of get a little bit of mental work going about the smaller scenes that might connect those high dots along the way can be really helpful, because then when the players do something weird, you know, like say, I'm going to start a drinking competition in the tavern, you're not totally blindsided, right? You think, well, I didn't plan for this eventuality, but I knew that there was going to be something happening here, and so I can just more quickly kind of come up with stuff on the fly and make it seem like I have my stuff together, right? Because that's kind of our jobs, right? It's making sure that we look like we know what we're doing.
Can I jump in again?
Yeah, absolutely.
So I just want to second what my two colleagues have both been talking about. I think it can be a danger, a temptation for us when we write an adventure as a DM, as a GM, to overplan it, right? We have these really cool scenes that we are really excited to show, and then the players don't go there, and it can create anxiety and frustration for everyone, because the players are also trying to think, what does the GM want us to do? And they can't read our minds, so they get frustrated. We get frustrated when all of our time and effort doesn't pay off. So one solution, one way that I've often thought about this is to think, rather than of trying to plot out the entire night's play or even the entire adventure, to instead think of choke points. Like, I know they're going to start at A, and how they're going to get to C. At some point, they're going to be at C, but I don't know what B is. Like, I don't know how they're going to get from A to C. I just know that at some point, they're going to have to talk to this guy, right? So I've got that choke point scene while still trying to be as flexible as I can before the choke point and after the choke point. Now, the ultimate expression of this, have you ever played Fate? Has anybody here played Fate at all? So the Fate core book says the only scene you should invent is the first scene. Give the players a clear problem and make it clear that they are the only ones that can solve it in the first scene for the night, for the session, and then step back and improv everything else, right? Because this is, and the goal of that is to create a maximum character empowerment, so that the players feel like they're the ones deciding the story. Now, not everybody's game likes to do that, right? And Fate's got a lot of, Fate doesn't have all the fans in the world, because people think that it's a little bit too loosey-goosey, a little bit too narrative, and they want more of a, you know, they want a dungeon or whatever. But that's just kind of like the far example of what we've all been talking about, which is try not to overplan it, listen to your players, and acknowledge that you don't know what your players are going to find cool. Like, you could put a million things in that cool adventure and they will pick the million and one, right? Is that even a word, million and one?
Like, it is now.
Yeah. It can be really frustrating, but the answer to it is just to be really ear-tuned to your players. And when they find something they really like, and they're not going to cue it in really big. They're going to make one little comment like, oh, that's cool, or they'll want to know if they can buy that piece of gear that NPC has, and you're like, oh, you like that NPC, don't you? That character's coming back, right? And you got to be really, really tuned to what the player characters want.
That's a really good point, Jason.
Yeah.
That's a really good point. Any other questions from you guys out here? We got one from Twitch. Do we want to take the Twitch one first? Or do we... Let's get you back there. Yes.
There's a school of thought from some popular online DMs that you're a custom world that you should also have a previous empire or civilization that is no longer around. Mm-hmm. The magic items and the artifacts that your players are now finding.
Yeah.
One, do you agree with that? And two, if you do, what do you go about doing it first? Do you build your current world or your previous world?
Sure.
Interesting. What do you guys say?
Okay, so we'll call this the founder's problem. Right? Because Star Trek has the founders. They're the people that created all of the species that miraculously all look the same except for their bumpy foreheads. Right?
So very quickly, the question was, if you have an ancient civilization that's behind the current civilization, which do you build first?
Well, and the idea is that you need to have an ancient civilization in the first place, which is also pretty... My answer is no. But I'm just kind of against hardcore rules like that anyway. You know? But I can see why you would do it. It serves a purpose. If that's the game you want to run, where the player characters are sort of like pathfinders, or they're like archaeologists, or they're going around digging up the relics of the old civilization, and that's part of the plot that you want to do, then by all means do that. But anybody remember who Ray Winiger? He wrote for Wizards for a long time. Anyway, he did this wonderful series of articles back in the third edition days called Dungeoncraft. Yeah, remember them. And he had one big rule, and that was never invent more than you have to. If you start world building, you will world build forever, and you'll never run the game.
That's true.
Right? His first adventure, he said, look, all you need to know is how far can the players get in one day? Like 20 miles, right? So you have your center town, and you got to plan out 20 miles in every direction, and that's all you need. You need to know where the nearest 7th level cleric is, because when a player dies, they're going to want to get raised dead. Right? You have to have these basic questions. And so this idea of like this great big ancient civilization, and you have to make all... No. If you spend all of your time making up that ancient civilization, when are you going to have time to run the game? Run the game. Put the ancient relics in your setting. You don't have to explain them. Let the players come up with reasons for why these things exist, right? And you can invent this stuff up as you go. You got a cool idea, put your cool idea in there, but don't struggle to come up with ideas if you don't have a cool idea. Right? I'm a big fan of like leaving wiggle room in the setting. It's a giant black obelisk with weird runes on it. What do the runes mean? I don't know. But if you give me a week, I'll figure out an answer, right? Yeah, so my advice is don't let world build, and world building is fun, but don't let world building get in the way of running the game.
Yeah, totally. What do you say, Eleanor?
Yeah, I pretty much agree that you don't have to do that. Presumably, if you're running a game, you're probably not the first... Your players probably aren't the first sapient people on the planet, so there was probably somebody before them. But the question is whether that is needed to run the game that you want to game. And the answer, it's going to depend on you and your players and what story you want to run. And I think more important than, you know, who came before us is... Why is what is happening now happening? Mm. That may involve, you know, some past historical conflict or somebody screwed up way a million years ago and now we have to deal with the consequences. But maybe it doesn't. Maybe it's something that just sort of started up right now and you only have to figure out a week before the game started what's triggering all of these events, or maybe your characters just don't actually care. Maybe they just, you know, run through the dungeon, there's squiggles on the wall, and they're like, cool, and that's that's the end of it. And so you don't really want to waste your time on things that aren't necessarily going to come up in the plot. Because as you said, you can world build forever. Yeah. And there's no guarantee that your players will appreciate it or care, for that matter. And sometimes you just want to retroactively put That's things right. in depending on something that happened. One of the games that I ran, we started off playing a module with our characters, and then when we finished the game, we all decided where we came from retroactively. And that's just sort of built this interesting world all on its own with no GM planning required. So I say, if you want to do it, just ask yourself, how is this impacting what's happening now? And if it's not impacting anything, then consider how it might be, or just skip it.
Yeah, I would really focus on constructing your main story and the world that you need for your main story and building in those details. Of course, making them consistent as you can, but doing it just to serve that main story. Like they said, otherwise you'll just be world building forever, which is great if you want to do that.
Yeah.
Sounds like
it's
you think you'd
fun.
Like to write a novel, which is also totally awesome. So I think we have a question from Twitch.
So Twitch from Phineas asks, any thoughts on portending future events?
Any thoughts on portending future events?
Oh, sure.
Interesting. All right. What do you got, Jason?
Well, I mean, so prophecy is a classic of not only the fantasy genre, but kind of gaming in general, and it's very tempting to do. The biggest problem with prophecy in your game is that when one of your players quits and joins the army, right? And you've made a prophecy about that character, and now the character is gone, and you're like, how do... Or one of your players gets a significant other and drops out of your game, and you're like, okay, well, now what do I do? So there's a lot of unpredictability in our player character group, and it can be hard. So my suggestion is to keep it vague and give it tags that you can exploit later. So I'm going to go into my my King Arthur stuff for a while, a little bit here. I like I said, I do some King Arthur gaming in the present. Well, so I can present a prophecy that says something like, you know, the warrior, the bear shall strike down the dragon. Okay, now that dragon and that bear is so vague, I can make that prophecy mean anything I want. Right? I can put a guy in a UCLA Bruins jacket and he's the bear. You see? And you can do anything with that. And so give someone a cool prophecy, give it some adjectives or nouns that are suitably vague, that are obviously symbols, but the players don't know what they're symbols of, and throw in some red herrings, like a guy whose name is, you know...
Bill.
Is Bill a bear?
Yes. I don't know.
Put in a character whose name is Drake, and they're like, "Oh, that must be the dragon, right?" Of the prophecy. Well, maybe, right? I mean, if the character's still around in 10 sessions and the players liked him, it was him all along. But if they didn't like him and that character got killed, then you can create a new Drake that fills the role, right? Or reveal that one character's middle name is actually Draco or whatever. I mean, anyway, that's a bit over heavy-handed, but you get the idea.
What do you think, Eleanor?
Should one of us mention that Galarian specifically doesn't have prophecy
to avoid
this problem? But that's not the question. So, keeping it vague is definitely on the list of things to do. I would take two approaches to that. One of the approaches is just to completely wing it with random symbols so that even the GM doesn't know what's going on. And usually the PCs will find some series of events to sort of jam in there and decide that the prophecy has been fulfilled. I used to do like, as a fun thing for a LARP, I would do tarot card readings.
Yeah.
And because I knew what was going on, I could sort of, you know, push interpretations onto the cards, but I was just drawing them at random. I didn't rig them at all. And there was one time where I just drew gibberish, and I was just like, I don't know what any of this means. So I just read the face meaning of the cards. And then the next week I came back, and the players were like, it all came true! And I was like, okay.
Right. You looked very smart, didn't you?
So that's one way to do it, is just let the players handle that. The other thing is avoid prophecy on your players, because you don't know what they're going to do.
Mm-hmm.
But you can portend events that if they don't happen, the game basically doesn't happen. Like, presumably, if your main villain is this, you know, guy who comes out of time, you can pretend that he's going to come out of time. Because if he doesn't, then none of the events happen, nobody goes on any adventures. And by the time the players realize it's going to happen, they're presumably not going to be able to stop it. It's probably already happened. Generally, when it comes to prophecy, I like to quote from Ursula Vernon's comic Digger that it's only good for kicking yourself in the face afterwards in hindsight.
Yeah.
But, you know, you can do to portend, like, clues for the plot going forward. Just don't get your players involved in it, I would say.
Yeah, I'm a very big fan of using prophecy very sparingly, and so that way the impact of this prophecy is something that is really meaningful to the players,
mm-hmm.
and it's something that the players are very invested in over a long period of time.
Mm-hmm.
If several sessions pass after you've given this very foreboding type of prophecy and they don't really get a lot of clues, or maybe they get clues that really aren't meant to be clues, then
mm-hmm.
it really just kind of builds up that mythos in their mind.
Yeah.
So that way, when you as the GM come to something that maybe you intended, or maybe you're shoehorning into fulfilling that prophecy
mm-hmm.
or shedding light on that prophecy, then it's all the more meaningful for your players. Using vague language is a really good way to do that in sort of the Macbeth tradition of,
oh,
you know,
that's a great example.
I will never be defeated,
yeah.
Except for by someone not born, a man not born of woman, and the trees will rise up against me.
Yeah.
And, you know, those are all very ridiculous sounding things, but then, you know, for those of you who know the play, those things actually happen, but in a way that he doesn't expect.
And then you get to watch Tolkien do his version when he writes Lord of the Rings,
yeah,
in which the Witch King is killed by someone not born, not a man,
yeah.
And the trees actually do come to life and destroy this
yeah, and
evil
so
castle.
That's just a very effective device for you in your games with your players, and can really be memorable in ways that we've talked about, scenes being memorable before, but this is sort of over a longer period of time. So it's a very fun device to use.
Yeah.
We're pretty much at the end of the panel, so if we have one very quick question. Okay, let's go with you, and then if we have time, we'll get you.
How do you guys deal with, like, when bringing in expansions and stuff and trying to make things fit?
How do we deal with bringing expansions to make things fit?
Okay. Like rule expansions and stuff? Like suddenly a new prestige class appears?
Yeah, a new prestige class appears. Or, now we're going to be fairies, and now we're werewolves, and things like that.
Well, sometimes these things have to wait for the next campaign, right? Like if your players are already doing their thing, all you can kind of do is offer the options. And if the players jump on the options and one of the players says, oh, I want to make a werewolf now, then you're like, okay, let's make a werewolf and let's use it. But sometimes if they're already pretty deep in your story, don't feel obliged. I mean, you bought the new book and it's really pretty shiny and, you know, you want to jump in there. But the next campaign is just around the corner. You know, so maybe save it if it doesn't fit. Don't force it. That's my if a player is excited about it, then jump on it. But don't feel like you have to.
The players don't need to all blow all of their cool ideas in one game, and you don't have to always let them do that. That's your prerogative as the GM. Do you have something on that one?
I mean, generally, if all of your players are on board with it, you don't necessarily need to go into huge depths to justify. You can just do the, I don't know what you're talking about. I always had this giant monster following me around. And in some cases, there might be ways to just have it be a natural expansion of the characters. It's like, oh, I got bitten by a vampire, so now I'm using these Dampier rules or whatever. You can always do the ye old training montage where they meet somebody who knows this cool new option, and they're like, I'm gonna learn it, and then you just sort of retcon as them retraining their old classes and into that sort of thing.
Yeah. One of my groups likes to just outside of the game all decide what their characters are doing together and creating a lot of weird backstory stuff.
Oh, really?
So then it gets complicated because it's like, oh, so you're this person's older brother who's younger because time shenanigans, and you're in love with this person, and it gets weird.
Well, you can either put up with it because, let's be honest, most Big Two comic fans just put up with that, so, you know, you can if you want.
That's true.
Or you can just say, okay, you guys, we're retconning the past because all this stuff happened, so sort it out and give me a neat backstory of what all you guys are doing now, and we're going to run with it that.
If you are finding it a problem, though, if your players are conspiring outside of the group, outside of the table, so much that you're having a hard time making an adventure for them, tell them that. Like, you know, they're grown-ups, presumably, right? You can say, listen, you guys are over-planning for me. Like, I feel like you're already writing the whole story and I don't have any wiggle room left, right? Can we find a happy medium here? Can we strike a balance? If there's something making the game session unfun for you, tell them about it, because they want you to have fun too.
All right, well, we are at our time, so if you have a question, you feel free to come up and ask us, or we'll be outside or at the show for the whole time. Thank you all so much for coming to this panel.
Thank you so much.
We had a great time. Have a great show.